Hello, listeners. Just a quick warning that this week's episode contains a discussion of some pretty horrible death threats and harassment.
Coming to you live from Amsterdam and Paris, this is The Europeans.
Except it's not live at all. Hello, Dominic.
Hi, Katie. Yeah, that's true. I shouldn't lie.
It's not live. It's Sunday here. A very nice, chilly Sunday. I've had an ice-themed weekend.
No way. I'm so jealous. What have you done?
I went ice skating on the top of Montparnasse Tower. It's a skyscraper in the middle of Paris. Really hideous skyscraper. But I heard that they put an ice rink at the top, so we went up there. Only to find that it's not actually ice. It's kind of like plastic ice, which I didn't know existed.
Oh, yeah. I've seen one of that. It always looks really disappointing.
It was disappointing. And most people were on rollerblades, so it wasn't really ice skating at all. But it was still like really, it was a really beautiful blue day.
But it also sounds like it'd be really cold at the top of a skyscraper.
It was. It was very windy. I thought I might fall off. But that was cool. And then the amazing thing was that at the side of the ice rink, in inverted commas, there was a little mini curling rink. I don't think you could call it a rink. A curling strip where you could throw curling stones and watch them slide. And it was really exciting. And I think that our guest from last week, Finnish Olympian Una Kauster, will be very proud of me for having had a go.
That's so cool. Are you like ready to try out for the Olympics yet?
No, I was pretty terrible at it. And also, there weren't any of the brooms.
Oh.
They were just the big heavy rock things, which were really heavy. I don't know if that's if they were like legitimate curling stones. They were super heavy, so I just kind of chucked it, flung it with everything I had, which wasn't very much. You really do have to have some kind of proper muscles on you to make it work, I think. But that was very fun. And then I went to see I, Tonya, the ice skating film.
So did I.
Oh, what did you think?
I really enjoyed it. I liked the tone, personally. The fact that it like managed to be really darkly comic about something that is so tragic, and that it was really sympathetic towards her.
Yeah.
I thought that was really important, and yeah, I loved it. What did you think?
I thought Margot Robbie was amazing.
Yeah.
Because I used to be quite obsessed with ice skating when I was a kid, and I remember all of this happening. I would have been, I think, 7 years old, and I remember seeing Tonya Harding as this kind of villain. So it was quite fun to revisit it as an adult. But how are you? How's your week been?
Yeah, I'm fine. I don't really have any good anecdotes because I've just been working all the time. I had 2 13-hour days in one building with no windows.
I feel like every time I spoke to you this week, you were like acting in a different show, either the one with the orgy in it or the one where you have to dance with a bowler hat or...
Yeah, at least there's variety and it's nice being busy. But yeah, probably the most exciting thing that happened to me was that I went into the canteen and tried to take too much pasta and got told off by the chef. And she said that I had to leave some for the other people.
Told off by the chef. That's quite impressive levels of greed. Not even I have ever reached that level of greed before.
Well, I'm working really hard. Oh, and the other fun thing that happened to me this week is that in the midst of all the madness, I decided also to fit in an audition. It was an audition where when you get to just outside the room to the audition, the way they tell you that they're ready for you is that they ring a bell for you. I walked in and I was like, hello, good afternoon. And... they literally didn't say anything.
Why?
They didn't look up. They don't speak to you. So they just ring a bell for you. You're like a performing animal. The pianist and I didn't know whether we should start or not because they hadn't acknowledged my presence in the room.
You know, sometimes you see that in films and TV shows when like an actor is having a really bad audition and they don't even acknowledge them. I didn't realise that actually happened in real life.
Usually people make an effort to make it a nice experience for you because they know that it's never fun doing auditions. But in this case, they didn't. And my other friends who did the auditions had a similar experience. Although one of my friends, when the bell was rang, turned the corner and said, "You rang?" And apparently she did manage to get a little laugh out of them.
Oh, I really hope she gets the job.
Yeah, me too. Fingers crossed.
She totally deserves it. Anyway, what have we got coming up this week, Dominic?
There's been like a really steady stream of news about the growing wolf population across Europe in the past few weeks. So yeah, we thought it was a good topic for us to discuss at the Europeans, seeing as wolves aren't aware of the borders that divide Europe's countries. And also that every country that encounters these wolves seems to be dealing with it in quite different ways. So we are going to be calling up a wonderful expert, Max Rosberg, the chairman of the European Wilderness Society, to get his opinion on what should be done to manage the approximately 20,000 wolves that we share this fair continent with.
Is it 20,000? That's amazing.
Yeah.
And then we're going to be talking to the Greek-Swedish journalist and rights activist, Alexandra Pascalidou, about her recent experience meeting up with a former neo-Nazi who had been sending her abuse for years and years. She's written very powerfully about her decision to forgive him. I was really quite moved by it. So we wanted to ask her a little bit about that experience and also dig in a bit to the resurgent neo-Nazi scene in Sweden. Wolves and neo-Nazis, there is really something for everyone coming up in this episode. But first, it's Good Week, Bad Week. Who has been having a good week in Europe and who has been having a bad week? Should I go first with the good?
Yeah, go for it.
It's been a good week for Martin Selmayr, the EU's most powerful official, just got more powerful. So if you're listening to this from America, which I think quite a lot of you are, or maybe even in Europe, you'd be forgiven for not knowing who this guy is. Martin Selmayr is the chief of staff to Jean-Claude Juncker, who's the president of the EU Commission. And he's German. He's got quite a reputation for being tough to deal with. His nickname is The Monster. And he's really thought of as being the real kind of power behind the throne in the European Commission.
Just like you, Katie.
Just like me. The real power behind this podcast.
Europeans.
Juncker, his boss, is not seeking a new term when his time is up next year. So there have been questions about what's going to happen to lovely Martin. But he's now been given a new job as the European Commission's top civil servant.
Yeah, when you say given, it seems like he kind of grabbed it, doesn't it?
He did kind of grab it. He got rushed in and the whole process was choreographed very carefully so that no one else in the EU could really complain about it. Everyone just turned around and it was like, ta-da, I've got a new job. And so very good week for him. Bad week for his many, many enemies around Europe. I think it's fair to say that he is not well-loved in Brussels. Some people describe him as having turned Brussels into a Belgian version of House of Cards. There's lots of plots and backstabbing and stuff like that. He trusts no one. He never lets anyone get near Juncker. And he's seen as having made Brussels a very sort of top-down place where not very much is up for discussion.
I'm really fascinated by this obsession at the moment of people comparing politicians or civil servants to Frank Underwood from House of Cards. Who was it recently? Gavin Williamson, the new British Defence Secretary. He's meant to be Britain's Frank Underwood.
Yeah, except he's not.
No, except he's not. It got me thinking. Oh, I sound like Sarah Jessica Parker in Sex and the City. It got me thinking.
As always.
I want to know who all the people that are being compared to Frank Underwood are across the continent, and I want us to make one of those beautiful European maps with it on. So please send in whoever your national Frank Underwood character is, according to your local media.
That is such a good idea. That's a great idea. I'm just trying to have a think about who France's one is. Is there an obvious Dutch one?
I don't know. I maybe need to speak to my husband about it, who's not here.
So Martin Selmayr's had a great week. I think the Brits in particular are probably not very happy about him getting even more powerful.
He's an avowed federalist, isn't he?
He is. He's a really interesting person because, like, a lot of people hate him. But in terms of Europe, he's really a very passionate European. He has a very clear vision of what the continent should look like. And he will stop at nothing to get it done. Quite interesting. Apparently, his love of Europe comes from when he was a kid. His granddad took him to the World War I battlefields in France and told him, your generation has a duty to make sure this never, ever happens again. And it left a really big impression on him.
Oh, it doesn't sound monstrous at all.
Monstrous pro-European. Who's had a bad week in Europe?
I had decided on Jeremy Corbyn for the bad week slot this week, but actually in the last 24 hours, there's been a bit of development that made me think that maybe the week's taken a turn for him. Anyway, I'll get to that and I'm going to stick with it. So Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of Britain's Labour Party, hasn't had a great week because the right-wing press and the Conservative Party have been rubbing their hands in glee at this juicy story that first appeared in the Sun newspaper about Jeremy, or Jezza, allegedly having met with a Czech spy a handful of times during the Cold War. Now, there's no evidence that Jezza was aware of the fact that this Czech diplomat was a spy, and there is now even some evidence provided by Corbyn's office to suggest that the spy has many of his facts wrong, and he doesn't seem like a very reliable source. For example, one of the meetings that the spy alleges was the day after Corbyn's mother's death, which kind of seems unlikely. Corbyn's official records show that he was in Derbyshire that day, not London. And the spy also claims they met in the Commons on a Saturday when the House doesn't sit. But even if they did meet, which I think Corbyn's office say they could have met at least a few times, the spy also alleges that the reason why he met with Jeremy and 15 other MPs was in order to secure private information about Margaret Thatcher and what she eats and stuff like that, which obviously the Thatcher allergic Corbyn knew all those juicy details. So the Czech authorities have confirmed these meetings but say that Corbyn was not an informant, and that Sarkozy, the spy, I don't know how to pronounce that, they say that he's not a reliable source. Even despite the unreliable nature of this story, I'd say it's still been a bad week for him, because the right-wing press have really pushed this. There have been days and days of front-page headlines with innuendos about Jezza, the communist, selling British secrets. But the reason why I think that it's taken a turn for good recently is because on Saturday, yesterday, at the time of recording, Conservative MP Ben Bradley was forced to issue a grovelling apology for falsely stating on Twitter that Corbyn had sold British secrets for money. So he's not only had to publicly apologise in quite like a funny way, but he's also had to make a donation to two local charities. I think one is a food bank.
Oh, that's good.
So maybe Jezza is having the last laugh.
How?
Is there another city wolf around near you that I hear?
As far as I know, we haven't got one in Paris yet, but they are cropping up in lots of different places all over Europe, aren't they?
They sure are, which is in many ways good news, because the wolf is a critically endangered species and is protected by EU law. And the European wolf community nearly disappeared in the 19th century. So we are going to be speaking in a minute to Max Rosberg, who is the chairman of the European Wilderness Society.
Do you know what I really love about Max?
What?
The way he signs off his emails. Wild regards, Max. Wild regards. I love that.
That's brilliant, isn't it? Well done, Max. So to give you a little rundown of some of the different wolf situations across Europe, in France, Macron's government announced last week that they were going to allow the wolf population to grow by 40% by the year 2023. This was hailed as pretty good news by conservationists, but the French farmers were pretty chagrined. I don't think you can use that in past tense. They argue that they'll lose profits due to livestock being killed by wolves. In Germany, they seem to have a bit more of a successful solution for managing wolves, where poaching them is like an absolute last resort. Belgium had their first wolf spotted over 100 years, I think 2 weeks ago or something.
Yeah.
Sweden have been criticised by the EU for culling a small proportion of their wolves. One area that I was really interested in was in Chernobyl.
Oh, yeah.
The exclusion zone between Ukraine and Belarus has seen an unexpected boom in the wolf population because there aren't humans living there. There's an estimated 300 wolves living there.
Wow. Radioactive wolves.
It's quite an emotional topic for quite a lot of people, because people feel like, oh, wolves are scary and we need to keep away from them.
Yeah, I think especially for urban areas, you know, as soon as one appears near a city, people are like, oh, should we get the guns out? No country has really worked out how to properly manage this balance between what do we do for farmers who are, you know, losing sheep because wolves are coming back and eating them because they've got to eat something. And how do we balance that with the need to conserve what is an amazing animal and something that's really important for biodiversity in Europe?
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, to what extent are we more happy to get rid of wolves because of the kind of history and literature with the big bad wolf thing? Whereas another predator like the lion, we idolize and celebrate because we think it's so beautiful and we all like the Lion King. It's all the fault of Little Red Riding Hood, I think.
We need a new musical that like really lionizes, not to mix up metaphors, lionizes wolves. Maybe we should get our resident jingle composer, Jim Barn, to work on that.
Absolutely. Get on it, Jim. And in the meantime, let's give Max a call.
In Townsberg, in the beautiful Austrian countryside. Do you have wolves in your area, Max?
We had one a couple of years ago, and another one just walked through a couple of weeks ago, and they're going to come back. So you will have wolves in Paris very soon. So I guess, you know, there's now a wolf pack in a suburban area of Berlin and another one in a suburban area of Rome.
That's crazy.
Wolves do not need wilderness. They only need food. that's the reason they're returning so much food, because of the inability of the hunters to regulate nature, that we've got 11 million excess of red and roe deer in Europe. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're coming back. It's gigantic McDonald's for them with unlocked doors. In this ecosystem, you do need predators, because it's the predators who are keeping everything into check and balances. If those top predators are missing, everything below it comes unbalanced.
You mentioned, for example, having too many deer. Why is having too many deer a bad thing?
They eat every young tree that comes out of the ground. They're damaging the forest to such a large degree that we in Austin and everywhere else are now trying to keep the deer out of forests, because the whole forest industry is suffering millions of damage. We're not talking 1 million. We're talking hundreds, thousands of millions of damage, because the deer need to eat. And the wolf is reducing the number of deers. And Switzerland has now really released reports saying the forest has recovered dramatically since the return of the wolf.
But what do you say, Max, to farmers anywhere in France and Germany who say, look, I've had like a bunch of my sheep eaten by wolves this year. This cost me serious money.
I hear those reports, and we have to take them serious. But let's look at the numbers. Between 3-4% of the sheep die of natural disasters, lightning, drop of temperature, snow. If the shepherds are complaining that they're going out of business because of the wolves, they're going out of business because they're not looking after their sheep.
Well, and I'll give you an example. In France, for example, where I live, I think 10,000 sheep were killed in 2016 by wolves, and the government had to compensate them 3 million euros in compensation for those sheep. And they're saying, look, we've tried different things. We've tried putting up fences. We tried alarms. We tried lights. None of it works. What do you say to those people?
Well, they lost 120,000 sheep to dogs, lightning, and bad weather. So How come the 120,000 sheep are not a problem, but 6,000 sheep killed by the wolf are a problem? It's very simple. We have gotten used to a system where we lose sheep every day. Nobody complained. It was part of the system. It was priced in. And now the wolf comes. And we realize, we don't know anything about this animal, really. I bet you, if I ask you, what do you do if you now leave Amsterdam, you're going on a bicycle ride, you're stopping, and there's a wolf standing 20 meters away from you. What do you do?
Have a heart attack?
Get out your camera, take a photo, because this is an amazing situation. He will look at you, and he will just move on. There's been never really an attack of a wolf onto a human. But we lose every year 3, 4, 5 hikers in Europe by cow attacks. Huh? Now, why don't they make the headline? It's an unknown animal.
So why is it that many countries in Europe are able to get away with hunting and culling these endangered animals when EU law actually prohibits it, doesn't it?
This is basically a tribute to keep this one lobby group quiet. They want trophies. And suddenly we have a top predator right in front of our doorstep. We don't have to fly there. We want to kill it. So the politicians are trying to, at the moment, say, okay, look, you can kill 40. You can kill 20. They're saying, let them kill 10% as long as they leave the other 90% alone.
I've seen that Germany have been praised for their solution for managing some of these wolves. I know farmers receive quite good financial support there. And problem wolves attract using GPS to ensure they aren't getting too close to livestock or humans. And then hunting is left as an absolute last resort.
Problem wolves. What the hell is a problem wolf? Have you ever seen a wolf sit on the couch of Sigmund Freud? A problem wolf is actually the smartest wolf of the pack. If we do herd management, and we have to do it, because like I said, I mean, those sheep are worth protecting and we know how to do it. We use a typical standard system of toolboxes, a fence 1.10 meters high. We need herd protection dogs. We take the border collies. We take a shepherd again. By the way, a job that we got rid of in virtually every country in Europe, except France. Few are left in Spain and Romania, but even Germany doesn't have any shepherds anymore. So, you know, there's a lot of challenges that the wolf is posing us with. We have to recreate those jobs. Those old jobs have to come back.
Definitely a lot of food for thought there from Max Rosberg from the European Wilderness Society about how we think about these animals that we share our wonderful continent with. Do check out their website for more about their conservation work, wilderness-society.org.
So we are going from one set of big bad wolves to another really horrible set of tormentors.
I thought we were just talking about how wolves aren't that bad, though.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I have a feeling that we're not going to be told that neo-Nazis aren't actually really that bad in the next interview. If anything, I think we're going to realise that it's a much bigger problem than people are aware of.
Yes. So we're going to be speaking to Alexandra Paskanidou. She is a Greek-Swedish journalist. She works in Sweden. She was born to Greek parents. And she has spent her career writing about diversity, multiculturalism. She campaigns against racism. She came to prominence in the 1990s, first presenting a TV show about multiculturalism. As soon as she started that, she became the target of threats from racists, from neo-Nazis. But the reason that we're calling her today is that she's done something unusual. She got an email from a former neo-Nazi admitting to sending her torrents of abuse for years and years, and he was apologizing for it. And Alexandra did something that I think most of us probably wouldn't. She picked up the phone and she said to this guy, do you want to meet up for a chat? She wrote this really, really fascinating article about that experience. It was a really chilling insight into how members of this neo-Nazi group, the Nordic Resistance Movement, how they operate. There's all this stuff in it about how they rent farmhouses and essentially go there to do paramilitary training, learning how to beat people to death. And just the sort of volume of threats that they send as well to Jews, to immigrants, to gay people. It's really, really chilling stuff. But Alexandra, I think, is super inspiring when she talks about what she learned from this experience.
I was wondering if you could just give us a quick outline of how this meeting came about.
You know, as a journalist and as a public figure in Sweden since 1995, I have received so many threats on a daily basis, mainly from racists and Nazis threatening to kill me, to hurt me in different ways, to do terrible things, to torture me. They've been threatening me with rape and everything, mostly because I'm from another origin. I'm a migrant. I'm a working class kid from the poor suburb, and I was standing up for human rights. And back in late 90s, I had Nazis masked with weapons outside my home.
Oh, my God.
And it became a huge scandal. So I was in court for 1 year or something. So I had different incidents with Nazis during the years. And there have been periods where I just took time out and left the country. I went to Latin America for 3 months, and I was so afraid, and I didn't really get the support from the police, I have to say. So after so many years of this, what can I call it, with this fight, I received three letters within 1 month, three emails from three different men. Last September, two of these men have just listened to my first book, Beyond Mom Street. It's an autobiography, and it was released on audiobook. So they listened and they were like, I'm so sorry, I feel ashamed, I now have kids and I don't want anything like this happening to them. And they didn't leave me any numbers or they didn't ask to meet or anything. The third letter was like, hi, I'm Martin, I'm writing to you because I want to ask forgiveness, and I've directed so much hate against you over many, many years. I called you late night telling you I was going to do terrible things and so on. And I just want you to know that I've left the Nordic Resistance Movement, the Nazi movement. So that's it. And he left a number. As soon as I read the email, I called him because I felt so optimistic suddenly. I felt so happy that there is somebody who regrets what he's done. And this. So I called him and I was like, hi, can we meet? I'd love to meet you and hear more about your journey and what you've done and how you reached the point to ask forgiveness. And he was like, yeah, okay. And I found out he's like in a city very far away from Stockholm, like 4 hours on a train. And when I told my friends, they were like, oh my God, you're so naive. Perfect possibility for this guy to kill you. I mean, you know, you can go there and it's a trap. And then I'm a freelance journalist, and I mentioned it, a newspaper, Dagens Nyheter. They were like, yeah, why don't you write about it? So I met Martin, the demon, the guy who poisoned 30 years. You know, being a mother and a single mother, having like phone calls at night when you put your daughter to bed, having a voice, a male voice whispering, I know you're at home with your daughter and I'm coming to slaughter you now.
Oh my God.
And without any protection, without anybody backing you up or something. It feels terrible. But I listened to him. I was very interested, and I tried to not be that private person that was like struggling to survive at night and pretend in front of my daughter that everything is fine. There is no reason to be afraid of anything, and we are safe because we live in one of the most robust democracies in the world. Mm-hmm. And at the same time being scared to death. So when I met Martin, I tried to be the journalist. I tried to take a step back.
And what were your first impressions of him?
He was very honest. You know, he answered all my questions about how they worked, how they radicalized themselves, yeah. how they saw the world. Being a homosexual, it was a disease and they had to be erased from earth, and how they saw the Jews, the Muslims, the women, the role of the women, and why they hated me and other people like me, and how they learned to use weapons and how they tried to break people. It was fascinating, and I think it teaches us a lot about these kinds of movements that we have not only in Sweden. We have them around Europe, and they're growing, unfortunately.
I think the Swedish Nazi movement seems to be particularly visible. They go on these big marches with their green and black flags and everything. People think of Sweden, outside Sweden, as a very tolerant country. Why do you think this movement is so big and has been growing?
It's terrible. And you know, I think Sweden is generally a very tolerant country. We are a welfare country. We are a democracy that promotes equality. And it's easier to be a woman, a working woman here in Sweden. But we still have so many problems that we don't really talk about. Sometimes we think that tolerance is about tolerating Nazi expressions and other extreme opinions like that. We've had quite a naive view on these groups. And somehow we think they can't do much damage. But the history and the facts show us the opposite.
Yeah,
they have murdered people, even policemen. I mean, we had like Alexander murders. We have Jon Hron. We have so many people that have been murdered by convinced Nazis here in Sweden.
So clearly something's not working out right with the authorities, and there needs to be more done to stop these neo-Nazis having a voice and having space to express themselves like this. But also, I was struck in your article about when Martin decided he wanted to repent and leave the community. He reached out to the authorities to see if there was any help he could get, and there wasn't any. They basically turned him away, and eventually he had to go to an anti-fascist organization where he was able to find some help. Through this experience, has it got you to thinking about how best to help them recover?
You know, I was wondering, what if Martin was a jihadist?
Yeah.
And if he called the authorities and nobody helped him. I think that we should really be open to these guys who are ready to leave extremism behind. But in the same time, I also have my other home country, Greece, in my mind all the time, because there we have neo-Nazis in the parliament. You know, we have Golden Dawn, and they are criminals, and they're not even, you know, trying to hide it. I think this is really a problem for Europe that we have to address together, and we have to fight this together, and we have to find ways of building bridges and initiating dialogue.
I think one of the nice things about Europe is you can look at these problems that are kind of appearing all across Europe and then see where they're being dealt with the best. And an example I found when I was researching this story was that in Germany, there's this organization called Exit Deutschland, which seems to be doing amazing work at helping recovering neo-Nazis. They've got some really original ideas, like they hand out t-shirts, supposedly neo-Nazi t-shirts at rallies, that when they then put them in the washing machine, the initial text rubs off and it tells them where they could get help if they want to recover.
Oh, that's amazing.
You're so intelligent.
Isn't it incredible? They seem like an amazing organization. They're run by an ex-police officer and an ex-neo-Nazi together.
Wow.
I just thought I'd wrap up by saying there are some people doing amazing work out there, and we just need to give them more oxygen and find more funding for them as well, presumably.
Are you still in touch with Martin now, Alexandra? Have you spoken to him? Do you know if he's doing okay?
Yes, he's doing great. I called him last night, in fact, and we're friends. We're talking. The other day, I received a threat, and I published it on my Instagram. It was somebody who was like, oh, I wish your daughter is going to be gang raped by Muslims or whatever. And Martin was, in fact, the first person to call me and say, hey, this is terrible. I'm so sad for what's happening to you. And we're going to give a speech together in a couple of weeks. And he's fighting to find his place and his new identity because, as you know, it's not something happening overnight that you suddenly wake up and you're, you know.
So few people would think if somebody gets in touch after years of tormenting someone, oh, you know what? Let's meet up for coffee. I just think you've been amazingly brave about the whole thing.
Yeah, and able to call him your friend. It's amazing.
Yeah, but it's so funny because everybody's, my God, you're so brave. How did you dare doing this? But, you know, it was an egoistic act because I feel free now. I can't carry the burden of hating a person that made my life a mess and, a nightmare. I feel so much happier forgiving him and forgiving anybody else who asks me to forgive them. So I really hope he's only the first of many, many, many to come.
That was the excellent Alexandra Pascaladou. We'll post a link to her article about what it was like to meet Martin. And we're going to be posting a bonus episode later in the week of our full conversation with her, because we ended up talking about all kinds of things, including what it means to her to be Greek and Swedish and European all at the same time, and a little bit of Eurovision as well. In the meantime, we could probably all do with a bit of cheering up after all that talk about neo-Nazis. So it's time for Dominic's happy ending.
So my happy ending this week is one that I actually got from your Twitter feed, Katie.
Oh yeah, so I know all about it.
Yeah, you don't have to pretend to act amazed. You can just feel smug.
Okay, as usual.
Yeah. It is the wonderful news that a painting by the celebrated French impressionist Degas that was stolen in 2009 was found on a bus during a random search by the police. So this beautiful painting, Les Choristes, was found in a suitcase in the bus's luggage compartment. Funnily enough, no one on the bus owned up to it being their suitcase.
You imagine if someone's just like some little granny was just like, oh yes, that's mine. I'm just taking it home for the weekend.
But I genuinely want to know more about this story. I want to know if the police like took down the names of everyone and interviewed everyone, because presumably one of the people on that bus is involved.
I think it was some kind of plan. I mean,
do you?
Yeah.
There's something that doesn't add up to me for this story. Like, I wonder, what are the odds that the police stop this bus and happen to look through that bag? Was it really a totally random search? Because if so, the burglar is very unlucky.
It would have been sort of wrapped up and stuff as well, you would have thought. And they don't normally crack open packages unless they think something dodgy is going on, do they?
Yeah. Have they got a sniffer dog for Degas paintings?
Yeah. What an amazing talent. I can sniff prices art. I wish I had that talent. I do have a sniff, so maybe that's what it'll turn into.
Oh, you sure do. So have I, actually.
Lovely. This is nice audio.
But I think you should find out a bit more and report back, please. Thank you.
Well, I should probably know more about it already, given that it's happening on my patch. But I had a very busy week covering other stuff, so sorry. But yes, it's very, very good news. It had been missing for ages and ages. He didn't really paint many paintings that didn't have dancers in them. And this is singers. It's opera singers, in fact.
I know, like me.
Just like you. I thought one of the ones at the front looked a bit like you.
Oh, stop it. Well, actually, I'm not going to take that as a compliment, because I thought they were all doing really bad, like, typical opera acting with their hands, which is pretty much frowned upon these days. Directors often say, like, no opera hands.
Is opera hands like jazz hands?
A bit like that, but worse.
Da-da! Look at my opera!
Thank you very much for listening to another episode of The Europeans. You can find us on all the socials at European Pod. I've really taken to using the term socials.
That's terrible. No, don't do that.
So on Twitter, we are at Europeans Pod. On Insta, we're Europeans Podcast. I don't know why we didn't choose the same Twitter and Instagram handle. That was a mistake.
It's nice. It adds variety.
Yes. And our email address is europeanspodcast@gmail.com.
If you're an interesting person around Europe, which of course you are, or there's something that you think we should be covering on the show, give us a shout. It'd be really good to hear from you. And also, we would really appreciate your a follow on Twitter just because the sex bots are back, Dominic.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so we need to even out our following with some more actual human beings. I don't know why they like us so much.
It's because we were retweeted by Spotify this week.
Oh, do you think so? I thought it was maybe because we were sexy.
Oh, yes, that too, probably.
Have a great week, everyone. And next week, I reckon we're probably going to have something from the Italian elections. Berlusconi is attempting a final election win. Will he manage it at the tender age of 81? Who knows?
Probably.
Stay tuned.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi. This is Andre, and I am celebrating the 100th anniversary of the independence of Estonia on February 24th, 1918. And I would like to offer the listeners of the Europeans podcast this Estonian palindrome. Kuuli lennu tee tunneli luuk. Again, that is kuuli lennu tee tunneli luuk. And it is a word that means the hatch of the tunnel along which a bullet flies in a ballistics investigation. Thank you.